This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. According to the latest national surveys, well over 80% of Americans consider themselves religious. And they certainly have a wide variety of faiths to choose from. But that was not always so. How we got to where freedom to pick any religion, or no religion, was considered an inalienable right is a fascinating tale, and much of it takes place in the Old Dominion. Two Virginia scholars who've long studied the history of religion are here with us this hour. Their stories about the colorful personalities who spread religion across the Commonwealth, how religion and public life have frequently intersected, and revelations about which faiths actually fought hardest for religious liberty are coming up right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. How important is religion to you? How important was it to your parents, your grandparents, your great-great-great-great-grandparents? I know I was absolutely fascinated when some years back a great uncle showed me a family Bible that had been passed down through many, many generations of his line of the family. And in addition to all the notices that trace births and marriages and deaths and other news, it occurred to me to ponder just how significant church life must have been to these people who mark their most important occasions in a huge treasured book that was then passed on to their children. A history of religion in the Old Dominion is our focus today. And if you have ponderings about your ancestors' experience of religious faith, or questions of any type about religion and history, please remember that you are invited to join us at 888-WMRA-TALK. Two historians are here with me in the Insight studio. Andrew Winmer is a faculty member in the history department at James Madison University. He has written extensively about the connections between race and religion in both American and Virginia history. Stephen Longenecker is a professor of history at Bridgewater College, and he has written a book about one very specific element of Virginia history titled Shenandoah Religion, Outsiders and the Mainstream from 1716 to 1865. Gentlemen, thank you both for making time for us.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, how much do we actually know about what was going on in the religious life of Virginians 200, 300 years ago? And Andrew, since you're a return visitor, let's start with you.
Well, we know much more than we did 20 years ago. We know very much more than we did 50 years ago. And one of the things that scholars are starting to argue is that perhaps religion was more important for the very earliest Virginians than we have thought for centuries. Maybe part of the reason that we typically have a stereotypical view of New Englanders, early New Englanders like the Puritans and the Pilgrims, as religious, contrasted with money-grubbing, commercially-oriented Virginians who arrive in 1607 in Jamestown. One of the reasons for that very common stereotype, I think, is that the Pilgrims and the Puritans wrote a lot more about what they were doing. And so we have an extensive archival record to allow us to explore their religious lives. Early Virginians had a different kind of religious life. They wrote less about it. They talked less about it. And their form of religion was more about making themselves comfortable in the world, making themselves at home in the world. It wasn't oppositional in the way that Puritanism was. Puritans were deliberately leaving the church in England and trying to purify, critiquing the church of England. So one of the things that scholars have started to do is to try to look at what Virginians left behind. It's called material religion. And the idea is that religion embeds itself in objects, not just in texts, and we can perhaps recover the religious meaning of people's lives by looking at the things that they built or the objects that they used. And I think the most important discovery within the last decade is the discovery of the early church at Jamestown. This was just discovered 2 years ago in 2010. Archaeologists working at Jamestown discovered the first Protestant church in North America, and it was built in 1608. That's just 1 year after the first English settlers arrived in North America. And there are a couple interesting things about the church. One is that it was built so early. Jamestown, in the first years of its existence, was a very difficult place to live. Disease, attack from local Native Americans, it was a death house. And yet, the first settlers found time to build a church. That tells us something about its significance in their lives. Secondly, it was a very large structure. It was about 64 feet by 24 feet. That's a little bit smaller than a tennis court, but it was very large for that time and that place. It was a grand edifice. It was by far the largest structure in the fort at Jamestown. And that tells us something interesting. It tells us that these people expected many settlers to come to the church for services. It tells us that they were willing to dedicate substantial resources to building a church at a difficult time in the colony's life.
Well, Tom, I agree with what Andrew just said. Your question was about 100 years ago, 200 years ago, and 300 years ago.
You can go back as far as you want.
Well, that's as far as I want to go back this afternoon. That's almost three different questions because in the more recent period, the printed records are much more available. There's congregational records, congregational books, denominational periodicals. People left journals. And your question was, what do we know about the religious life of people? And 100 or 150 years ago, actually, we know quite a bit. And as in the earlier period then, what Andrew said about material artifacts, about material history, really starts to kick in. We have to be a little more creative as we resurrect the religious life of early Virginians. In a sense, that's what historians do. We bring people back to life. We resurrect them.
And, well, your book, okay. Stephen Longenecker, Shenandoah Religion, covers a 150-year period, starting at 1716 and going till the end of the Civil War. One of the things that I was fascinated by in the book is the evidence that you find of how Andrew was saying that religion, different religions, were so important to different people, and also some of how attitudes towards religion and which types of religion became more predominant changed over that 150-year period. But if you can, and I don't know to what degree you found evidence to do this, I'm wondering what you can tell me about the importance of religion to people in the Shenandoah Valley, which is the area that you cover in the book, in the year 1716, and how that compares with the importance of religion to people in Virginia today.
Well, the easy way to answer that question is religion was much more important in 1716. Trends are very secular today, and there's a significant portion of the population that really has very little religious identity. But in 1716 and the entire 18th century, religion was core to people's lives. It was bound with their ethnicity. For Scots Irish, they were just Presbyterian. Many of the English were Anglican. That was the majority faith. Religion, ethnicity, country of origin, all those were blended together, and religion was a huge part of identity.
And I would add that another important difference between today and in 1716 was that in 1716 in Virginia, there was state religion. There was an established church. The Anglican Church was the official church of Virginia, and there were people who disagreed and didn't want to join. But if you lived in Virginia, you paid a tithe. You paid to the parish. And Virginians actually paid 2.5 times to the parish what they paid to the county in taxes. So in political life, the local vestry was important. In economic life, people are paying to support the Anglican ministry.
People not just wore their religion on their sleeve, but they wore their denomination on their sleeve. And while the Valley was much more tolerant than east of the Blue Ridge, it was still possible to run into trouble in the Valley. for believing the wrong thing or for believing a for being a minority position. It was definitely more important than today. I don't know the religious beliefs of the two of you. I don't know what your denomination is. I mean, it's not on your sleeves at all. And so that's a huge difference from the period you cited recently.
Another big difference is that we tend to think of Virginia as largely Baptist or Methodist or evangelical, broadly, evangelical Protestant. In the 1700s, evangelical Protestants were not the majority. They were a feared radical fringe minority, and they were persecuted. There are stories from diaries in the 1760s of a local Baptist minister standing up to preach, and the Anglican parson rides up with the sheriff right next to him and starts horsewhipping the Baptist preacher, pulls him off the pulpit when he tries to pray, bangs his head into the ground, and then the sheriff starts horsewhipping him and takes him off to jail for dissenting from the Anglican established church. So evangelical Protestants were seen as a threat to the established religious order and also to the political order. And I think that's the difference as well, that we tend to be very comfortable separating religion and political life. In fact, we prize that separation. In this period, the two were seen as building into each other. And so there was a lot of fear on many people's part that if you had religious diversity, the polity, the local government couldn't survive, it couldn't stand, and society itself might disintegrate. And the threat of evangelicalism was especially that because of its emphasis on the new birth, on the individual standing before God that seemed to promise some kind of spiritual and perhaps social equality, that the hierarchies that kept society together, that made it function, the hierarchies of men over women, of masters over slaves, of white over black, of rich over poor, and of elderly over young, that those hierarchies would start to disintegrate. And of course, Virginians didn't like the fact that evangelicals were criticizing their dancing and drinking and horse racing either.
Religion in Virginia History Watchers Andrew Whitmer and Stephen Longenecker are our guests. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. And to you listening, I'm curious, what do you know about the history of religious faith in your own family? Do you have any stories about how that played out in Virginia or anywhere else? If you're willing to join in, we've got a phone line open for you at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. Or you can post to us on Facebook, where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. And we have this just come in on Facebook from Ron, who says, religion is a perfect tool for divisiveness and tribalism, antagonistic to critical and analytical thinking, and toxic when mixed with politics. Stephen, that sounds like the kind of opinion that demonstrates what you were saying about religion and what's acceptable to express about religion is a lot different today than it was a couple hundred years ago.
Well, that's a short question, but there's a lot in it. Religion is not always divisive, and sometimes religion can be unifying. The doctrine of pietism. Well, we've been talking about evangelicalism and born again religion. That was a thread that united a variety of different ethnic groups and denominations. In some ways, that was a unifier, particularly here in the Valley. That was a unifier rather than a divider. Of course, it was controversial, but it also made a strong commitment towards understanding. The diversity in the Valley, in the long run, I think, tended to be a contributor to the First Amendment. The Valley was a spinoff from Pennsylvania. And those who wrote the First Amendment, James Madison was particularly aware of the diversity in Philadelphia and Pennsylvania. He wrote to friends in Philadelphia asking about, hey, how's it work? How's it work up there? And then we got the First Amendment from that. So in sometimes religion divides. We won't talk about the 30 Years' War. But sometimes it can be a unifier.
We do
well.
Have much more to talk about history of religion in the Old Dominion, in 1 minute. Author of the book Shenandoah Religion, Steve Longenecker, is one of our guests. Sitting next to him, co-author of the book Prophecies of Godlessness, Andrew Whitmire. This is Virginia Insights. I'm Tom Graham. Let's actually, there's so much fascinating stuff in your book, Stephen. There was a section there, and I think that's the first or second chapter, where you're talking about this, I think, really gives people an idea of how, I don't know if the word primitive is appropriate, but how early or beginning things were in the early 1700s in the Shenandoah Valley when it came to the yearning to have religion and the role of some people trying to fill that yearning. So could I get you just to read that one paragraph there?
Early preachers themselves often reflected the immature institutional life of the backcountry with ordinations that were unacceptable in Europe. William One-Eyed Robinson, who itinerated through the valley from eastern Virginia, was a graduate, not of a Scottish seminary, but of William Tennant's Log College, a one-room schoolhouse that trained young ministers in Philadelphia. Robinson had lost an eye from smallpox, thereby gaining his nickname. Alexander Miller had been deposed in Ireland, but he appeared so repentant before the Synod of Philadelphia that they restored his ordination, and he filled a pulpit in the valley. Another backcountry pastor, Desolate Baker, adopted an alias, James Lovell, to conceal a checkered past of promiscuity, bigamy, and syphilis. Baker's partners included Black and Native American women, which made his transgressions even worse for his congregation. In 1746, Mill Creek Baptist excommunicated him for immoral behavior.
It sounds almost like Mr. Baker would be a good candidate for public office today, but I wonder if in that era that you're talking about, in the early 1700s in the Shenandoah Valley, when people were still trying to get their churches organized and they were relying to some degree on these itinerant preachers, if it wasn't the preachers who were the major public figures of the day and the major influence in people's sense of public life.
Well, as the frontier attempted to move away from frontier and towards something else, churches were one of the institutions that could accomplish this. Congregations are one of the first steps towards institutional maturity on the frontier. And most, not all, but many of the denominations, many of the traditions, needed an ordained pastor to accomplish this. And with most centers of most institutions of higher education somewhere else, maybe even across the pond, it was pretty hard to find a genuine seal of approval, ordained, blessed by the bishop or the synod or whatever, pastor to lead the congregation.
And I would say, this is Andrew, that absolutely ministers, preachers are the crucial public figures in early America. The first national celebrity was George Whitefield. He was the most famous preacher of the First Great Awakening, which took place during the 1730s and 1740s, a series of revivals that swept up and down the Eastern Seaboard. He was a member of the Church of England. He came and took America by storm, partly because he was very talented at publicizing himself through newspapers. Ben Franklin printed his journals and published them. They were bestsellers and helped to make Franklin rich. And George Whitefield is the kind of guy who, even if you don't like what he's saying, and a lot of people didn't, you want to go and hear what he's saying because everyone's talking about it. It's water cooler conversation. And I love the quote that you read from your book, Steve, and I think we could expand what you say about the self-invention or the reinvention of these men to American religion generally.
Let's do that in a few moments after we make room for some callers. Call in phone number if you want to participate in our conversation here on Virginia Insights with Andrew Whitmire and Stephen Longenecker is 888-967-2825, or you can simply remember it as 888-WMRA. Talk to Stanton now. Philip, thank you for calling in. Your question or comment for our guests, please.
Hey, sir. I wanted to just put my own family's story in there because it pertains pretty well. They were forced out of Germany for being Lutheran, so they came over to southern South Carolina and established the first Lutheran parish there. And the first two generations, they suffered some headaches. They had to anglicize their name from Liprint to Librand, and they had to do the all the headaches with the tithes and all that for their parish as well for the Anglican Church. But interesting to note, by the third generation, after the Revolution, South Carolina was strapped for men for the War of 1812, so they asked the third generation, my ancestor, to stand up a regiment of German-speaking South Carolinians for the possible invasion by the British. I think it was interesting to see the toleration, how quickly it changed within a few generations there. That's my story, and I just wanted to throw that out there.
Thank you. That's a great story. And I think it speaks to the central place of religion in people's individual lives and their family lives. It speaks to the growing religious diversity of life in the early American Republic. And one of the great stories of American history is the freedom of religion, especially after the establishment of religion dies in the era of the American Revolution. And religion is thrown on its own devices as a result of the First Amendment and the disestablishment of state churches, where if you're going to succeed as a religious body or as a religious leader, you have to attract followers. And so religion democratizes. Contrary to the narrative that many people, the story that many people tell about religion in the United States as steady decline from original unity, what we really see is, in the wake of the American Revolution, more and more people join churches, and religion becomes more central to the public culture of the United States. And I think the reason for this is that because establishment has ended and there's a free market in religion, religion has to learn to speak the language of ordinary people. It has to learn how to address their needs. It has to learn how to speak in the vernacular, the local language, and draw people into the congregations. Otherwise, they fail. And what we see is some amazing successes in the religious landscape of the early republic, and a lot of failures. A lot of churches or denominations go belly up because they can't figure out how to attract adherents.
Philip, that's a wonderful story that you told us about your ancestors coming from Germany. I wonder, can you tell us what time frame we're talking about? They're setting up the first church that they founded in South Carolina?
They came over in 1753 is when they landed in South Carolina.
And do you
exactly
know what?
When they departed, I'm not sure.
What religion?
Lutheran.
Yes, and they were, did you say, kicked out of Germany because of their particular version of Lutheranism wasn't allowed there?
Yeah, they had been landholders. I mean, they didn't hold a lot of land in Germany, but they held a little bit of land, but then they were forced out by their prince. And then so they left and went to England for a little bit, and then they set sail for South Carolina, and they got a deed to some land here. And then when they settled down, they got some slaves and land and set up a church and a graveyard, and it had been in the family up until Sherman marched through.
What a terrific story to know about your family. If it's not too personal a question, are you still of the Lutheran faith today?
No, sir. I'm a Catholic, which is sort of ironic, I guess, in the course of events. But no, my personal faith is that of the Catholic Church.
It's a wonderful story. Thank you so much for sharing it with us, sir.
Yes, sir.
Have a great day. 888-967-2825 is something that I should mention often enough so that you who are listening know that you are welcome to join this conversation about the history of religion in Virginia with historian Steve Longenecker and Andrew Whitmer. I guess we're going next to Woodstock. Jonathan, thank you for joining us on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment, please.
I don't live in Woodstock, but I'm a trucker, and I was passing through on I-81 and was fascinated by the program, and I love NPR radio programs, especially talk programs, and listening to you guys, and was was fascinating to me. I was curious about when did the first Jews arrive in the Shenandoah Valley, and what was that like for the folks who were here before the Jews arrived, and where did they settle, and what did they do, and how did they make their living?
Jonathan, that's such a wonderful question. I think that we're going to direct it to our guest who's written a book about the history of religion in the Shenandoah Valley. And Stephen Longenecker, it also reminds me that as you demonstrate for that 150-year period up to the end of the Civil War, most of the religion in the Shenandoah Valley was some version of Christian Protestant. Even the Catholics didn't get much of a toehold here.
That's right. I don't know much about Jews in the Shenandoah Valley before the Civil War. I don't think there were very many here. The first synagogue in Harrisonburg was established in 1867 during the Reconstruction period, which is kind of an interesting thought about why that happened.
Why do you think it happened?
I think there was a collection of obviously the fellowship was large enough to establish a synagogue. But why a few more Jews came to Harrisonburg right after the Civil War, I don't know. I could only speculate. Maybe there was enough rebuilding going on. I mean, there was a lot that was destroyed. There was a small building boom, and maybe that provided enough jobs for new people to come in with special skills. Before the Civil War, most Jews in the Valley were peddlers or storekeepers. Maybe a few in each town, but not enough to establish a synagogue.
So in terms of Jonathan's question about when the first came, we really don't know, but it sounds like there were at least some people of Jewish faith here before the Civil War, and their presence really was more obvious after the Civil War.
That's fair.
Jonathan, thanks so much for a great question. I think we might have lost Jonathan, but we're grateful for his call. 888-WMRA-TALK is how to reach us by phone. On Facebook, we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. From Bridgewater College, Professor of History and Political Science, Steve Longenecker is one of our guest chairs. From James Madison University, Professor of History, Andrew Whitmer. This is Virginia Insight. If you just joined us, we're taking a look at the history of religion in Virginia. I'm Tom Graham. I think we've got Lee in Bridgewater next. Lee, thank you for joining us. Your question or comment, please.
Oh, I don't have a question, but I do a slight comment. I was living over in Madison County, and I became interested in the churches in that county to see if I could find out how many there have ever been and where they're located, of course. And I started collecting information that the parishioners had written or was in the church records. I found original deeds when they were available to me. And I can appreciate the Baptist preacher coming down and being horsewhipped. This same kind of happened right over in Culpeper. This was in the time when Culpeper was still a part of Orange County. This would have been back in the early 1700s. I found such things as church, a house of ease. I think this was by the Church of England.
I'm sorry, Lee, you said a house of ease?
House of ease.
What does that mean?
There was no church, no Church of England at that time in the area, but a pastor would come down once a year, and he would meet with people in the area, and he would perform marriages and baptize children, pray for the people who had passed on. It was strictly outdoors. No real building or anything like that. This was something similar to what was happening when they had the house was just called a grove. In a grove of trees, This is over in Syria, I believe I found this.
Lee, hold on just a second. I want to check. Andrew Whitmer, I see you nodding your head. I'm guessing that the kind of work that Lee was doing and the discoveries he was making is something of an amateur church historian resonates for the kind of work that you do.
Absolutely. So I'm curious to hear more about what you discovered, but I think often this is how we are able to reconstruct the deepest religious beliefs and experiences of individual people through reading back through old, dusty, crumbling records. And I've spent time reading the records of First Baptist Church of Charlottesville during the 1840s, 50s, and 60s, and to try to reconstruct the lives of that the people in that congregation and the complex dynamics between African Americans and whites who were part of the same body. You're looking at church discipline. You're looking at baptism records, who is included, who is excluded or excommunicated. What were the records that you found most useful in trying to reconstruct what religion meant to these people?
Actually, I found the church records. I tried to get copies of the church pastors. Sometimes they had kept the records, and lots of times they had not, particularly back in the very beginnings. I found, of course, I mentioned the deeds. I did manage to interview one person who was then in her 80s, and she had been a youngster, a girl, in a black church in Syria that I went to look at, and it's all fallen down. And I asked her.
And I'm sorry, I may not be as familiar with the geography as I should. Is Syria a town in Madison County?
Yes, it is. It's a, well, yeah, I guess you could call it a
town. It's important to underscore that, because there may be other people like me who are thinking that you were talking about the Middle East. So I'm glad we got that clarified.
I understand. Okay. I asked her, said, well, you people were Baptists. Oh, I didn't see anything in the ruins where there would be a baptismal. And she said, well, no. On the road going north through Syria, you find by the river a very big oak tree. And that's where we used to baptize people, was in the river, right there by that big oak tree. Yeah. Some of the stories that came down from the parishioners are very interesting, and you can find.
I gotta ask Lee, and we're getting close to a break, so I apologize for trying to make this quick. But what possessed you to get involved in this kind of history search about religion and old churches?
Well, I'm a retired professor, and I was. It seemed to me that this would be a good activity. Retired, of course. To have an activity that would keep me busy.
What were you a professor of?
A professor of psychology and education.
Wow. And it sounds like you probably get a lot of interesting peeks into the psychology of people over a couple hundred years.
Oh, 300 years. You'll find a copy of my book in the library in Bridgewater.
And what's
Bridgewater
the title of the book,
College.
Quickly?
A History of Madison Churches, 1725 to 1996.
Lee, thank you so much for calling. We're going to continue our discussion here on Virginia Insight in just a bit more than 1 minute. From James Madison University, Professor of History Andrew Whitmer, and with us, sitting next to him from Bridgewater College, Professor of History and Political Science, Steve Longenecker. We've got some phone lines open. If you have a story about anything to do with the history of religion in your family, or, for example, what, if anything, did you learn about religion and Virginia history in school, and how much of it do you now as adult question? Do you think it was on target? Is there anything that wasn't quite right? If you've got a theory or a factoid you want to check out, you can reach us at 888-WMRA-TALK. So, one of the books that you contributed to, Andrew Whitmer, is, I think it was called Crucible of the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
And you wrote a chapter that was called Race, Religion, and Rebellion. And just the first paragraph is beautiful. Would you just read from that book the first paragraph for us, please?
The reminiscences of Horace Tonsler, born into slavery in Albemarle County, Virginia, in 1857, offer a revealing glimpse into the structure of race relations in Central Virginia churches during the Civil War period. When we get to the church, Tonsler recalled, the white folks would go inside, and the slaves would sit round under the trees outside. Then the preacher gets the white folks to singing and shouting, and he starts to walking up and down in the pulpit, and every once in a while, he leans out the window and shouts something out to us black folks. That's a quote. Relegated to the periphery, the slaves took full advantage of their situation. Tonsler described how from time to time an older member of the black congregation would rise from his place and quietly begin shadow preaching, waving his arms and contorting his face in imitation of the white minister, to the endless amusement of his fellow slaves. The satirical aspects of these performances were scrupulously concealed from those inside the church, and the practice slowly grew into something more serious. According to Tonsler, whites became accustomed to the arrangement and eventually allowed their slaves to preach and pray for themselves under the shade trees surrounding the church. I love that story. It's from an interview done with Horace Tonsler, a former slave during the 1930s. And it suggests so much about the complexity of life within a church, a biracial congregation, a congregation in which African Americans and whites, slaves and slaveholders, came together around a shared faith, but came together in the midst of a society that was structured by the hierarchies of race and of slavery. And that story tells us something about the togetherness of these groups that were divided in the rest of the society. It also suggests that those social divisions were at play within church life as well in destructive ways. But I think it suggests that within religious life, African Americans had some quite rare opportunities in a slave society to assert their authority, to stake a claim to spiritual equality.
I found less of that in the Valley. I certainly agree with the general point. But in the Valley, whites seem much more interested in keeping African Americans under control. It's especially prevalent among Methodists. There were more Methodists in the Valley than almost everything else put together. And the Methodist Conference included the Valley and Maryland, Baltimore, and even some of southern Pennsylvania. So it was a really interesting mix. And they were just really careful to keep blacks under control. They thought independent African American religion was dangerous. On the other hand, I have found some expressions that support Andrew's point. Certainly blacks were able to, in some traditions, particularly the Baptist tradition, were able to give an account of themselves. There were a few black preachers before they were allowed to join. Everybody, including African Americans, had to give a testimony, had to convince the rest of the congregation that their experience was valid. And there aren't any other venues in which African Americans can speak publicly, speak to whites, sort of on a serious one-to-one basis and be taken seriously.
I think where we run into trouble is saying religion did this or religion did only that, in terms of religion was a liberating force or religion was an oppressive force. We can find evidence of all of the above. And the range is as extreme as independent black churches, largely independent, with a great deal of autonomy, even permitted to use collections to purchase the freedom of enslaved people on the one side, to churches in Virginia who held slaves. The church actually owned the slave before the Civil War.
There was an example of that near Farmville, wasn't there?
Ryrie Presbyterian Church in Prince Edward County, between the 1760s and the 1860s, owned slaves. Dozens of slaves.
Well, there were congregations that hired out their slaves, which was considered an especially harsh form of slavery. They hired them out to pay the preacher's salary.
So every year, the slaves would be put up on auction, and the highest bidder would be able to rent them for a year. It was a way, if you weren't wealthy, to have a slave. And the concern on the part of some people in the congregation was that this was the worst kind of slavery, because slavery was an institution that evolved. And one of the ways that it developed in connection with religion over the course of the early Republic period and the antebellum years before the Civil War was in terms of paternalism. Slaveholders, Christian slaveholders, justified their slaveholding by claiming that they cared for their slaves, that their slaves couldn't care for themselves, that they were being Christianized and civilized, and that they were in fact benefiting from slavery. Even people who believe that have a hard time accepting the practice of institutional slaveholding, because it seems to remove slaves from the benevolent care of their masters. And I want to emphasize that that pro-slavery ideology was an attempt at the time to justify slavery.
Religion in Virginia History Watchers, Andrew Whitmer and Stephen Longenecker are our guests. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. We've got the phone line open at 888-WMRA-TALK if you'd like to join the discussion. We go next to the community of Green Mountain, and Noora Dean is joining us. Noora, thank you for calling in. Your question or comment, please.
Well, I've been hearing, good afternoon, I've been hearing a lot of talk about Christians and some talk about Jews, but nobody's mentioned Muslims in Virginia. And, of course, Muslims have been in Virginia for a long time, since the time of slavery, of course, because many of the, at least half of the slaves who came here were Muslims. And I myself, I'm a Anglo-Irish American Muslim whose family has been living here since the late 1600s. And so you have this other community, but nobody seems to have mentioned it at all. And you find, around the area of Northern Virginia, 250,000 Muslims living there, and practically every other city in Virginia, there are masajid or mosques, as you call them, including places like Farmville and other places that you wouldn't think of it, Muslims living there. So I thought that you should add that into your mix.
Well, I really appreciate the comment. And Muslim slaves have not been studied extensively. I absolutely agree with you. You're very correct that many of the slaves were Muslim. They were literate. They must have been really interesting people. They were disciplined. They weren't literate in English, but they may have been more literate than their masters. But there weren't enough of them to sustain the community. To preserve any kind of religious tradition requires a fellowship and community, and they were just too isolated. They couldn't set up the infrastructure. They couldn't set up the kind of educational facilities that sustenance of a tradition requires. And so, after a generation or two, they seem to have disappeared.
Noora Dean, you had a follow up?
Yeah, I would disagree with you on that, because there's a continuity of community from the 1600s to the present, among both white Muslims and African American Muslims, and we may have, grown few in numbers from time to time, but there's a constant continuity, and we know our history, even if you may not be aware of our history, but we're aware of our history.
Trace that connection for us, because we typically, when we're talking about
that,
Noora Dean, hold on just a second. Well, Andrew Whitmer has a question for you.
Yeah, I'm interested to hear you speak about that continuity. Typically, when we talk about slavery and traditional African religions, we say something that was similar to what Steve said, that in the Upper South, African slaves are more isolated. They tend to be held on as slaves with only a handful, if any, other Africans. And so it's harder for them to maintain community and to maintain connection to their cultural past. Whereas in the lower South,
part of what might be different here is that as historians, the two of you and everybody else in your profession who investigates these kinds of issues rely on written records. They rely on diaries. They rely on baptismal certificates. They rely on church organization records. And it may be, and Noora Dean, I want to check with you about this, that there's an oral tradition among certain faiths that you all, as professional historians, don't really get to see. But Noora Dean, it's my impression from what you're saying is that there's word that's been passed down through your family line from your ancestors on that you've heard the stories about, but there may not be any written record of?
Yeah, well, you know, it was mainly, you know, like Immanuel Kant, you know, who famously, you know, said that people were civilized in accord to, you know, their having or not having books. But oral history, for some people in some parts of the world, who are not primarily literate in that sense of books, is long and continuous. And so, you know, we can understand that where your two historians may be coming from, where they might not be aware of that, but the oral history, which is what we depend upon a lot, is very continuous, and we're very well aware of who we are and how long we've been here, and both white and black.
Nuradine, I am so grateful that you've added this dimension to the discussion. Thank you so much for taking
time
to call
us. Thank you for taking my call.
Before we end this discussion, Andrew Whitmer and Stephen Longenecker, I'd like for us to address a little bit about what religion and politics looked like in earlier Virginia history. Fair amount of controversy today about how much religion is involved in politics and how much should be. Let's go back to the time of Thomas Jefferson. Is it true that there was angst in his day about accusations that he wasn't a Christian, he was a deist, that he wasn't, because of his religious faith, qualified to be president of the United States? You're both nodding your heads.
Well, yes. I think your statement is an understatement. There was tremendous fear about Jefferson's religion, mostly fomented by the opposition. If you're looking for common threads, exaggeration and smear and pulling small points and making large points out of them, part of politics then, and it's part of politics today. Jefferson was pretty close to a deist, which is somebody who believes that there was a creator who then stepped back and is not an active part of the world. Jefferson stripped the Bible of the miraculous. He was not a Christian. I don't think he believed that Jesus was divine or the Son of God. Traditionalists claim that if Jefferson got elected, you'd have to hide your Bibles, and you know, there'd be infidels running amok. And so people were really worried about Jefferson's religion.
And I think the context of those fears is that religion and politics were not seen as separate things, especially in a young democracy where it was democratic. And the thought was that democratic success in a fragile young republic depended on the virtue of individual citizens. And where was that virtue going to come from? Well, many people thought it was going to come from traditional religion. And so on up into the Civil War and well beyond, Americans wrapped their politics in religion. And we can see many examples of this, including the debate over secession in Virginia in the lead up to the Civil War. Would the South secede and form its own nation? This was not just a political decision. For many Virginia Christians, this was a moral decision. And there was a large Unionist contingent right up to the first shots being fired on Fort Sumter in April of 1861, who said, we should stay in the Union. Partly, we should stay in the Union because the Union has always protected slavery, is what they said. But also, we should stay in the Union because God has ordained political authority, and it would be immoral to leave.
We haven't talked about
one other thing that I want to make sure we get to before we run out of time, and we're close to that. The degree to which, was it Baptists, played a significant role, especially in Virginia, especially in the 1700s up to the early 1800s, of pushing for religious liberty, freedom?
That's right. Well, look, I want to go back to Andrew's previous point. We haven't mentioned anything about Valley Anabaptists yet, but the Brethren and Mennonites were Unionists in the secession crisis, and a lot of that had to do with their religion and with their position on slavery. And now your point about Baptists and religious freedom. Well, there's a lot of truth.
And just to separate, Anabaptists and Baptists are completely different.
That's almost, look, everything in religion is complicated.
Okay.
But almost
but
completely
continue
different.
Your,
yeah.
Continue your point.
Okay,
please.
Okay. Look, everybody wants a piece of the First Amendment and the struggle for a religious freedom in Virginia. And Baptists played a huge role in that. But other
scholars when they were a pretty small minority.
A lot of people give Presbyterians credit for that, too. There's huge petitions sent by Presbyterians in the middle of all that debate.
And Andrew, this gets back to a point that you made early on. One of the things that they objected to was the whole idea of paying taxes to support Anglican priests.
Jefferson and the Baptists are unlikely bedfellows, but they're allies because both have a problem with established religion. Jefferson has a problem with it because he thinks that religion corrupts politics. The Baptists have a problem with it because they believe that politics represses or distorts religion.
Such fascinating stuff. Our guests have been from the History Department at James Madison University, Andrew Whitmer, and from the Department of History at Bridgewater College, Stephen Longenecker, who is author of the book Shenandoah Religion, Outsiders in the Mainstream, 1716 to 1865. Thank you both for making time for us.
Thank you.
Insight's executive producers, Matt Bingay, our associate producers, Terry Ward and Bob Levicky. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Juspe and Inner Rhythm. Thanks for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more Insight.